to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. Since we were last together 1 week ago, several reports, articles, and announcements related to global climate change have come out. First, the day after my last program, the New York Times ran a large article that included an interview with the chief of the Data Management Applications Division at the World Meteorological Association, which is in Geneva. And the article by Sarah Lyle, reporting from England, was entitled Heat, Flood, or Icy Cold, Extreme Weather Rages Worldwide. And the article opened with this overview. Britons may remember 2012 as the year the weather spun off its rails in a chaotic concoction of drought, deluge, and flooding. But the unpredictability of it turns out to have been all too predictable. Around the world, extreme has become the new commonplace. Especially lately, China is enduring its coldest winter in nearly 30 years. Brazil is in the grip of a dreadful heat spell. Eastern Russia is so far into freezing, minus 50 degrees Fahrenheit and counting, that the traffic lights recently stopped working in the city of Yakutsk. Bushfires are raging across Australia, as I mentioned last week, fueled by a record-shattering heat wave. Pakistan was inundated by unexpected flooding in September. A vicious storm bringing rain, snow, and floods just struck the Middle East. And in the United States, scientists confirmed this week that last year was the hottest since records began. So then it goes to her conversation with this expert from the World Meteorological Association who tracks these events. And he, Mr. Omar Badur, said, each year, quote, each year we have extreme weather, but it's unusual to have so many extreme events around the world at once. The heat wave in Australia, the flooding in the United Kingdom, and most recently the flooding and extensive snowstorm in the Middle East, it's already a big year in terms of extreme weather calamity. He means 2013. And he added, such events are increasing in intensity as well as frequency. And then the next day, Saturday, January 12th, the draft of the third National Climate Assessment was released. It's compiled by an independent interagency group of 240 scientists, businessmen, and experts in various areas. It's issued every 4 years, or at least it was supposed to be issued every 4 years, because the first one was in the year 2000, after which the George Bush administration actually just called it off for 8 years. Anyway, the 2013 National Climate Assessment, the third one, states that the impacts of climate change driven by human activity are spreading through the United States faster than had been predicted, increasingly threatening infrastructure, water supplies, crops, and shorelines. And only a few days before that third National Climate Assessment was released, NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, released its annual State of the Climate Report, which noted that 2012 was, as we know by now, the hottest year on record, and it was 3.2 degrees above normal. And by the way, 2012 was only the second worst year on a measure going back many years called the Climate Extremes Index, surpassed only by 1998. Also, the accounting's not finished yet, but so far, 11 climate disasters last year have each exceeded $1 billion in damages, including several tornado outbreaks, Hurricane Isaac, which hit the Gulf Coast in August, and late in the year, of course, Hurricane Sandy, which caused damage likely to exceed $60 billion, primarily in the Mid-Atlantic region. Among those large-scale disasters was one bearing a label many of us had never heard before, the derecho, which is a term for a line of severe, fast-moving thunderstorms, such as the derecho that struck central and eastern parts of the country starting on June 29th. And that one killed more than 20 people, toppling trees and knocking out power for millions of households. Well, back to the series of recent developments. 2 days ago, on January 15th, 18 of the nation's leading climate scientists released a letter that they had sent to President Obama, urging him to say no to the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline. Here's what those climate scientists wrote to the president. Quote, 18 months ago, some of us wrote you about the proposed Keystone XL tar sands pipeline, explaining why, in our opinion, its construction ran counter to both national interests and planetary interests. Nothing that has happened since then has changed our evaluation. Indeed, the year of review that you asked for on the project made it clear exactly how pressing the climate issue really is, unquote. Now, the State Department is expected to soon release its supplemental environmental impact statement that's required for the northern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline. And the department's previous pipeline environmental impact statement downplayed climate risks by arguing that the tar sands would be developed with or without the Keystone XL pipeline, and therefore the pipeline project had no responsibility for the additional greenhouse gas emissions that come from burning tar sands oil. But that's not what two of Canada's largest banks said recently, which was that without the pipeline, their growth predictions for the Canadian oil industry make no sense because the crude oil extracted from the tar sands would be stranded, as they put it. Now, those leading climate change scientists released their letter to President Obama on the same day that the Interfaith Moral Action on Climate group held a pray-in for the climate with interfaith religious leaders in front of the White House. That was the demonstration I told you about a couple of weeks ago, in case you wanted to join. They urged President Obama to take stronger action on the climate crisis. But how many times does it make sense to keep asking him that? As Bill McKibben wrote in an op-ed piece that ran in several newspapers about 10 days ago, quote, at President Obama's first post-election news conference, he announced that climate change was real. In deference to future generations, he also agreed that we should do more. But addressing climate change, he added, would involve tough political choices. And he would not, he said, ignore jobs and growth simply to address climate change. And then Bill McKibben says, the president must be pressed to do all that he can and more. But there's another possibility we need to consider. Perhaps he's simply not up to this task. And we are going to have to do it for him as best we can. Unquote. Then Bill McKibben went on to talk about the big climate demonstration that will be held in Washington on the Sunday of President's Day weekend, 1 month from now. That demonstration, called Forward on Climate, is co-sponsored by the Sierra Club, the Hip Hop Caucus, and 350.org. which is a grassroots organization pushing for serious action on the causes of climate change. It was founded by Bill McKibben, the prominent ecological writer, about 6 years ago. And the offices of 350.org were originally in Vermont, but they're now located in Brooklyn. As regular listeners know, I've mentioned several of their events and campaigns on this program. So I'm delighted to have with us today a very strategic staff member at 350.org. My guest today is Anna Goldstein. She's the U.S. Campaigns Coordinator at 350.org, an international climate campaign that works with volunteer activists in 188 countries to solve the climate crisis via online campaigns, grassroots organizing, and mass public actions. She works with organizers around the United States to help grow the climate movement with a focus on scaling up climate leadership through workshops. She's been a Fulbright scholar in Sri Lanka, an English teacher in Taiwan, a rape crisis counselor in Oakland, and a dog walker in New York City. Anna Goldstein, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, this is a weekly program about interrelatedness, the discoveries in so many fields recently that physical reality, including humans, is far more dynamically interrelated than modernity has supposed. One example of what I call the relational shift is the current transformation in the field of microbiology onto the relational perspective. But surely of all the recent realizations about dynamic interrelatedness, the interrelated factors driving global climate change should be front and center in everyone's attention these days. So, well, I'd like to begin by asking what drew you into activist work on climate change?
Well, I think it's very relevant to your focus. I've done a lot of different work in my life. I've worked on social justice issues from a very grassroots perspective, working individually with people on the ground, both in the United States and in several other countries, and I found that really rewarding. But I also wanted to scale up the work that I do, and I also wanted to work on my shift into working on climate change was because I felt that it was a good connector between so many different issues. A mm-hmm. lot of the things that we talk about are environmental justice issues. Mm-hmm. Why are the kids here in Richmond, California, obliged to suffer from asthma because the Chevron plant doesn't put in the respect and the care and the checks and balances needed for their public health? So that's connected to the climate crisis. The realist education around the world is connected to the climate crisis. So there are lots of different interconnected aspects here, and I thought that working on climate organizing would be one way that it could all loop together in a way that felt mm-hmm. deep and important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chevron just had yet another release in Richmond, California of toxic fumes just within the last 2 weeks.
That's right.
Well, the big question in my mind, I think a lot of people's minds for so many years, is that other industrialized countries, our peers such as, you know, I mean, our peers economically, such as Germany and Scandinavian nations, they've done far more than we have to cut the level of their carbon emissions, and they've done it without damaging their robust economies. So they clearly take global climate disruption seriously, and they just figured out how to get smarter about doing what they were doing. And it was really outrageous that the global climate crisis was not even mentioned by President Obama or the media in any of the three presidential debates during the campaign last fall at this late stage of the crisis. So I wonder what your sense is of why concerned people in this country cannot seem to get any action from our government after decades of laying out the facts and lobbying for what needs to be done.
Well, that's a complicated issue, and there's no one simple answer. I think that it's a combination of factors. I think that in the United States, a really, really important element is the fact that we don't have we're not even on the same playing field financially as the lobbyists from the fossil fuel industry.
Right.
So we don't have a level playing field. It's not as if we're having an equal conversation. It's not as if we have a baseline of scientific literacy that we can have a conversation on. It's a very, very skewed dynamic. And so 350.org organizes on a grassroots level because our sense is that playing the game in Washington with lobbyists and numbers and convincing people to vote a little bit here or come along and vote a little bit there has not shown to be effective, as you said. And so what we're trying to do is demonstrate that we can make the change we need. We definitely need national and international level change. We definitely need binding treaties on the UN level. We definitely need national legislation in this country as well as in other countries. However, a lot of awesome work is happening at the grassroots level, and there are municipalities that are making tremendous changes. There are individuals that are making tremendous changes, and maybe we're coming at it from another direction. I don't know why the president, I think it's a combination of factors. I don't have an easy answer as to why the president hasn't addressed this. I believe that as an individual, he realizes the situation is as dire as it is, but I think that politically, up until this point, he's felt constrained by the politics of the situation, by the pressure of the fossil fuel industry lobbyists, by the game of politics. And
all three of those come down to the campaign contributions. When they said something's not politically possible and the current politics wouldn't allow it, as you say, the lobbyists have just huge amounts of cash to give to the candidates, and the grassroots people do not. So there's certainly no point lobbying when the lobbyists are delivering those big pots of cash, and both parties are so desperate for campaign contributions from the big donors. So, you know,
right.
I think that was clearly on his mind before re-election, and now that he doesn't need to get re-elected a second time, since that would be impossible, according to the Constitution, that he would run again. Of course, he won't run again. And is he freed up now? Well, the answer is probably no, because his party still can't stand with the current system of the way the elections are run. They don't dare affront any of the big donors, whether they're corporations or wealthy individuals. So, it's definitely sort of a, you know, deadlock on what the politics for the common good need as versus how the system is skewed in the direction of pleasing the big money donors.
Right. So we've found at 350 that since we can't compete dollar for dollar, we won't even try.
Yeah.
We can't beat them in dollars, but we can beat them in passion. We can beat them in creativity. We can beat them in popular, creative action. And so we found
you can beat them at the polls eventually. I mean, you can convince people to vote that way. That's
what's
the only thing that will get their attention. I think you're totally right.
And I think that I think the wind is shifting on that, and I think that climate change is such a huge and overwhelming issue. There's a lot of moving parts, and there's not a straight line of science that says exactly what is going to happen. And so most people can't conceptualize an issue that huge and that complicated.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they have a scientific background, even if they're not morally or politically opposed to it. And so most people put it at arm's length. And it's sort of like the frog in the boiling water kind of situation. And so there are certain things that are tipping points for different individuals. I think that Hurricane Sandy was a huge wake-up call for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of the extreme weather situations that we haven't experienced that much in the United States compared to, say, some of our brothers and sisters in Bangladesh or mm-hmm. in desert zones, places where droughts and crop failures and floodings and hurricanes are already happening around the world. We don't live on an island that's 6 inches above sea level, like mm-hmm. our friends in the Maldives. They have been living the direct experience of climate change, and they're going to be climate refugees. Most people in the United States haven't had that experience yet, and so I think we're just
waking up. Well, we're on the way with that big drought.
We're waking up to it now. I think that the wildfires and the droughts, the extreme weather changes,
yeah.
you know, the hottest year on record, we've had the last 36 years have been progressively hotter. I think people are starting to get it in a very visceral way.
Mm-hmm.
And our hope is that they'll find ways to organize and get the message to the politicians who, unfortunately, are often even on higher ground, even less impacted by the day-to-day
yeah.
realities that people
right.
are feeling.
Yeah, that's a real problem. They seem so cut off from what most people are going through. I wonder, even within government, though, because of this shift you've been talking about at the grassroots, are there certain people in elected positions that you feel are now speaking out about climate change in ways that they weren't even 3 years ago?
Well, we have some awesome allies. I mean, on the federal level, there are certain senators
mm-hmm.
that have been tremendous climate champions. We helped support. We don't normally do a lot of legislative work in the United States, but we helped draft a bill last year that Bernie Sanders from Vermont and Keith Ellison from Minnesota introduced.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been real climate champions on a lot of different levels. And there are a lot of individuals, depending on the circumstances, that have also been fighting the good fight. Certainly on the local level, there are people doing work in the cities and towns and counties across the country that is wonderful work and that is hopefully creating models that we can scale up. Maybe the change won't come through senators in D.C. Maybe the change will come from mayors, people who see the day-to-day workings of cities and are able to take local action in a more quick way.
Yeah, that's right. I'm glad you mentioned that because that mayor's initiative on climate change, even back in the 90s, really showed that they weren't going to wait around for the federal level. And so many city governments have joined with that, making the effort to lower the carbon emissions in their municipality. So, let's focus on the work of your organization, 350.org, a little more. And would you first, please explain to the listeners the meaning of the name of the organization.
Sure. 350 is a data point. It stands for 350 parts per million of carbon dioxide, which is the safe level that it's measured. It's a composite number taken at different places all over the world. So, it varies a little bit from place to place and day to day. But up until the time of the Industrial Revolution, the carbon levels globally were about 275. And we're carbon-based life forms. Carbon's not a bad thing per se, but we've burned so much. We've used the fossil fuels, coal and gas and oil, to raise the planet's temperature in a way that's not sustainable. And the temperature's still going up. The temperature now, the parts per million now, is in the 390s. So 350 is the level we need to return to. We sort of look at it like, well, the patient's been diagnosed with high cholesterol or the patient's had a small heart attack. The patient's not dead, but there's been a big warning, and we definitely need to cut out salt and stop smoking and get more exercise and do whatever it is. We can fix it, but we've already had some extreme repercussions. And as the parts per million continues to rise, which it will, people negotiate the details of what level is going to be safe. But the top climate scientists in the world, including James Hansen of NASA, have cited 350 as the level that we should strive for. And
right.
So we won't get there tomorrow. The planet's going to heat up for a while before it even cools down. But it is an achievable goal, and there's lots of ways to get there. So by taking the name 350 for our organization, we acknowledge that it's a very real scientific conversation, but we also say that there's a million different ways to get us back to 350. We don't have a particular policy prescription as the one right way that we think will make that happen.
Right.
But we, through all of our efforts, we need to get back to that.
Yeah, there are lots of different ways. I've read about those. Well, the fact that you say we're now in the 390s and how extreme, and as the journalists say, spinning out of control these extreme weather events are getting, I think really should put an end to those discussions about, oh, well, it would be fine if we drift over into the 400s. I don't think so. I mean, clearly what you just said, we need to pull out the stops and get back to 350 because things are happening, the changes, much faster. You know, a scientific body will make a prediction and it's kind of hair-raising, and 18 months later they say, oh my gosh, it happened much faster than we thought. So, yeah, certainly.
That's right. We don't, I mean, the models, because we're sort of, they're very sophisticated computer modelings that people do, mm-hmm. but because we're kind of modeling these interrelated systems globally, the natural systems are more sophisticated than any possible model. So we can
right.
we can predict things, and in some cases the predictions are quite sophisticated and accurate, but there are sort of ratchets of connectivity that we might not even realize, and then
exactly.
And
there
and there are tipping points that we might not be aware of because we haven't been there yet.
Yeah, and also because our whole system of the mechanistic training in science in the West was not focused on studying how dynamic interrelatedness works, and we're in it now.
Yeah.
So, as you say, we're not really used to figuring how this is going to go. Well, one more thing before we take the break. I would like you to explain something else that I think 350 and Bill McKibben in particular, the founder, is very good at making this simple for people to understand. For one thing, what you just said, if you look on their website, 350.org, there's this chart, 350, here's where we need to be, and then you see the line go up, 390, here where we are. And the other thing that I thought was so helpful was the article that came out last August in Rolling Stone that Bill McKibben wrote called The Reckoning. And he gave three simple figures, three numbers, all people have to remember to get a grip on what's happening. Can you explain what those are and then the tour that came after the article?
Sure. Bill wrote this article, and he was trying to get people to do the math. And so we'd had a do the math tour, a road tour, so to get that word out, and we traveled all around the country. The three numbers that he was talking about are number one, 2 degrees. So no matter...
2 degrees Celsius.
2 degrees Celsius, that's right.
Yeah.
2 degrees Celsius, and that's another, because in the United States, that's another thing that is a bit confusing.
Yeah, 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit.
That's right. So almost everyone, even very conservative governments and conservative bodies, agree that the 2 degree threshold of warming is the bottom line. Right? That is, any warming above a 2 degrees Celsius rise is going to be unsafe. Everyone agrees that. So that's the first number, 2 degrees.
Right.
The second number is 565 gigatons. And this is not, you don't have to remember these numbers exactly. You have to remember the ratio here between the second and the third number. That's the scientific estimation of the amount of carbon, additional amount of carbon that we can still spend before we would get past that 2 degree threshold.
Yeah, our carbon budget. How much oil, coal, and gas could we burn to stay under the 2 degrees Celsius increase, right?
Correct. The third number is a number that is given to us by the Carbon Tracker Initiative, which are analysts and environmentalists based in the UK. And they say that the companies, the fossil fuel companies, and the countries that Bill says act like fossil fuel companies, hold reserves, estimated reserves of 2,795 gigatons of carbon. So it's five times the carbon that we can spend, but that's how much we're already, those companies and countries are already creating their wealth on. They're already saying
it's already,
like, this is,
it's already built into their projections.
That's
it's
right.
Built into their stock price. We have these 2,800 gigatons of carbon either in our reserves right now, or we own the land to dig it up from, and it's all part of our projection for how strong we are as a company.
Correct.
Yeah.
So the thing that's startling about that is that there's a real disconnect in between the reality and the reality of the, as Bill says, you know, the science, the physics, the chemistry, and the financial reality
the corporate
math making.
Yeah.
So that's where we're
more than five times as much.
Yeah.
You know, we could afford to burn 500 plus gigatons, but the companies are ready to dig up and sell 2,800 gigatons of the carbon sources.
Correct. So that's one of the reasons that one of our new campaigns is about getting colleges and universities and soon pension funds and other sorts of financial plans.
Oh, wait. I know where you're going with that. This is so exciting. I love that campaign, but it's time to take a short break. So
okay.
Can you hold that thought?
Sure. Thanks.
Okay. This is Charlene Spretnak on All Together Now, and I'm talking with my guest, Anna Goldstein of 350.org. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Anna Goldstein. The website address for her organization is the same as the name of the organization, 350.org. Now, before we get back to the action campaigns being mounted by 350.org for this year, I want to tell you about a related action coming up this weekend. It involves National Days of Action on or around January 19th, which is Saturday, and it's called Money Out, Voters In. These actions around the country, including teach-ins, rallies, and other kinds of events, will address the big underlying reason why we cannot get any votes in Congress on climate change or anything else that serves the public good. Instead, the druthers of the big donors to electoral campaigns, as Anna and I were just discussing, whether those donors are corporations or individuals, are the ones who must be curried and pleased. So January 19th was selected because that weekend marks both the third anniversary of the Citizens United decision at the U.S. Supreme Court, Citizens United versus the Federal Elections Commission. And it's also the Martin Luther King holiday. So the organizers chose that dual commemoration because of the other focus of the action, which is fighting voter suppression. You can go to their website and see where the event in your area will be held, because they're set up all across the country. And that website address is MoneyOut, written all as one word, no punctuation, MoneyOut-VotersIn.com. And one of the many organizations who are co-sponsoring this action on Saturday for free and fair elections and uncorrupt governance is 350.org. So Let's get back to hearing about 350.org's three big campaigns for this year. Anna, what was the first one you were starting to tell us about?
Well, we were talking about Do the Math, and the big campaign that springs from the Do the Math tour is our website is called gofossilfree.org, and you can get there via 350.org. And it's focusing on getting colleges and universities to divest their holdings from the fossil fuel industry. It's kind of modeled on the apartheid-era divestment campaigns that some of us were a part of. And we've got over 200 colleges and universities already that have started action, met with presidents of their schools, started student petitions, started organizing. So it's kind of exciting. Bill went on tour and kicked this off, and students really responded to it in a big way. And so we're hoping that this takes off.
So it sounds like you were on either all or most of the Do the Math tour. Is that right? And if so, what was that like?
I was on part of the tour, and I helped set the tour up, and it was great. I mean, it was kind of like, you know, being in a rock band or something, traveling on a bus and going from city to city, and big crowds. We had 20 plus venues, and we spoke to over 25,000 people. And Bill had different musicians and different local activists, and in some cases, special guests. We had Naomi Klein at certain stops, and Reverend Yearwood from the Hip Hop Caucus at certain stops, and he told the story about the math and about divestment and different ways that people could get engaged. And we had tons of students. It was very high energy, and it was fun.
I looked at the map of all the stops, and I thought, my gosh, this is a huge logistical operation, because, as you say, you have to organize who the local guests or musicians would be in every stop, and every day or every other day you're in a different city, and it just must have been a huge undertaking.
Yeah, we'd never tried anything like that before. Unfortunately, one of our staffers used to be a rock and roll guy, and so he knew more how to do it, and so it ended up working out. You know, we have a huge network of organizers around the country, so we would lean heavily on our team in each city to get all the volunteers together for the day of and spread the word to sell the house out. We sold out every stop.
Oh, great.
it was really fun.
Wow. Minus the Dom Perignon and the green room.
Yeah, there wasn't any of that. That's weird. We did have beer. Bill did a skit with beer. He made it an elaborate analogy.
I see.
And got the college students on stage with, you know, counting out how many beers it would be safe to drink.
I see.
There was a little beer, local beer.
Okay.
So,
the divestment campaign, I think, is hugely interesting. And as you said, people can learn about that through the link on the 350.org website. And then what about this big demonstration that's going to happen on President's Day weekend?
So President's Day is February, the weekend of February 17th. We're having an action in Washington, D.C. on Sunday, February 17th, and we are joining with a lot of organizations, but most especially this time with the Sierra Club and the Hip Hop Caucus. It's called Forward on Climate, because it's definitely targeting our president and his Forward campaign slogan.
Uh-huh.
So this is called Forward on Climate. And the Keystone XL, and we know that we will not solve the climate crisis one pipeline at a time. And we also know that there are certain iconic fights that we can win and certain fights that are very, very significant, morally significant, and also significant in terms of carbon. And so the Keystone XL pipeline is a pipeline that is proposed to run from the tar sands of Alberta, Canada, across the United States to the Gulf of Mexico, and
to a port, Port Arthur,
and then to be shipped overseas.
Yeah, outrageous.
It's sort of the worst idea ever, and it's something that we can stop. It's something that the president has a unique authority to stop because of its the status of the pipeline crossing the border and the way that it's set up. It's something that he can make the call on, unlike a lot of other issues. It's his decision. And so this is a place where we've chose to focus with so many of our allies who are fighting the pipeline on the ground in a million different ways. They're down at the tar sands blockade in Texas, and they're putting their bodies on the line every day. People in Canada are doing all sorts of work. Native communities are getting, you know, obviously cutting the pipeline will cut through native lands. And so we're hoping to have the largest climate action ever in D.C. on February 17th. We're inviting people to join us on the mall. And the message is to the president. The message is that this is your, you said you know about this and you said you care, and this is your decision and you can do it. It's going to be the way that you could make your legacy. I mean, now, as you said, he's not going to have to run again. So this is his legacy. What is he going to be known for? Is he going to be the president who, you know, drew the line in
or
the line
party
in the
hat.
Sand?
Right.
The line in the tar sands. So, so a lot of people, we've had over 10,000 people RSVP so far. We're hoping to get, 20,000 or more people there. About a year ago, we surrounded the White House with a pipeline, and he delayed the pipeline. We had a good reaction to that. They did more studies, and they postponed it. But now, you know, he's back in office, and we're back. We're going to knock on his door again.
Yeah. And this is not one where there are simultaneous demonstrations across the country. It's one where you're trying to get as many people to go to Washington, D.C. as possible?
Yes and no. Yes, we're trying to get as many people to D.C. as possible. Correct, this is not one of the sort of distributed days of action with hundreds or thousands of actions around the country or around the world. However, there are individuals and groups that are taking local action in different places. Of course, not everyone can or should go to D.C. We're hoping that people who can will. And then people who aren't able to or choose not to, there are going to be, especially west of the Rockies, there are going to be local actions in Los Angeles, San Diego, the San Francisco Bay Area. I'm hearing day by day more about that. But we're not doing the same. We're not asking people to do that, and we're not tracking it on a website as we would if we were saying it's a national distributed day of action.
Yeah, I see. Good.
Yeah.
I'm sure people can learn about that at 350.org.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now there's one more action coming up this year, and I know you're the manager for the actions inside our own country, but you probably know about this global power shift. It's going to take place in June in Istanbul, and the goal of that event, according to Bill McKibben's latest op-ed piece, is to shame the United Nations into action. So, how's that going to work, and who's involved?
Well, Global Power Shift will also involve some of us from the U.S. We're going to hopefully have, 500 to 600 people, largely young people, from probably 150 countries, meeting in Turkey. And we're going to do an intensive training for people. There's something in the United States called Power Shift that has happened for several years, where people come from across the country, they gather in D.C. and they learn about organizing, they meet each other, they plan campaigns for the future, and that's not a 350.org. We didn't start Power Shift, but we've been participants in it. So the Global Power Shift is similar, analogous to that, people coming together to meet each other, to learn how to do the best kind of organizing they can, and then to go back to their countries and create national movements and national power shifts to grow the climate movement exponentially. So we'll have some of the best and the brightest from around the world, and they'll get to meet each other and get inspired and get the tools that they need to go back and you know, take off.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And what are the dates of that? It's sometime
well,
in mid-June?
It's currently slated for mid-June, and I just heard a conversation that the dates may shift a little bit, but we'll keep people posted. We'll definitely do a lot of media about it so people know all the exciting things that are going on.
Uh-huh. So if people want to participate, really throw their time and energy into this, there are the actions this weekend. You can check on that site for moneyoutvotersin.com. And then one month from today, there will be the action in D.C., the forward on climate. And then beyond that, what would you advise to people across the country who would like to know how best they can really help out in this effort?
Well, one of the things about 350 is that we really encourage people to do, you know, as the theme of your program, there's many, many, many different parts to the equation and all interrelated. So people have different things that they're strong and passionate about. We do have local groups around the country, and you can look on our website and you can look and see if there's a local group near where you are. If there's one that's already up and running, you may wish to join with that local group. If there's not one up and running and you want to do more climate organizing, you can gather your friends and get one started. And we'll give you support around that as best we can. We'll have a platform. We have an online platform that will help you organize, and lots of resources and staff and so forth.
Oh, sort of how-to materials for starting up?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And so we encourage people to, you know, make those connections, find out what's going on in their own community. One of the cool things about 350.org is that we're international, and people feel really supported and tied into this global movement. So it's mm-hmm. inspiring to know that the work that you're doing in Sacramento is important in Sacramento, but that your brothers and sisters in the Sudan or Sri Lanka or Mongolia or Paris are also doing similar work, and you can be a part of this global community. You can join Facebook, 350.org on Facebook, and that's one place people have those conversations. If you do Facebook, we're doing that a lot, and we do a lot of Twitter. We do a lot of different social media things. But if you want to get basic information, you can just go to 350.org. You can register to be on our list. We send out emails, not too often, interesting, well-crafted emails, and not too frequent. So invite people to do that.
Well, I must say, when you just now were talking about being part of that planetary network, I felt that was so moving, took my breath away. And I want to thank 350.org because it needed someone to step up at the plate and organize this planetary network. And it wasn't happening, and it wasn't happening for decade after decade. So I think what you're doing is just hugely significant in our time. And I thank you so much, Anna Goldstein, for coming onto the program today.
Well, thank you so much. It's been great talking to you, and I know you and your listeners are part of this web of solutions, and they want to know more about climate change, then we're one place they can look.
Yeah, great. Okay. Let's move over to the Arts Corner. Our poem this week goes out to everyone under age 50 or so who has long been tired of hearing about the baby boomers talking about the 60s. This poem, which those folks in particular may enjoy, is by Mary Mackey. It's from her collection entitled Breaking the Fever. The title of this poem is When We Were Your Age. We have told you our youth was beautiful. We said we danced naked in the forest and lay with one another in the fields. We have shown you pictures of ourselves with our arms around each other, hair plaited with flowers,
tear gas blossoming behind us in great white petals, and on every face a smile of perfect conviction. We have decorated our houses with carved gourds from Peru, stone jars from Greece, and every time we dust them, we force you to listen to us tell you that when we were your age, we put everything we owned in a backpack. And hitched barefoot across Brazil, slept with cannibals, lived in caves, ate holy herbs, and learned to levitate. We never mention the nights of dysentery and raw fear, friends who shot junk and walked out windows, idiots who refused to feed their babies anything but raw broccoli and acid. Our romantic stories contain no lice, no death, no 18-year-old soldiers dying in the mud, no speed freaks in the next room breaking furniture and screaming that devils are coming out of the kitchen faucets. In these stories, no one ever walks in on her husband screwing a stranger on the living room rug, and no one ever has to be driven to the psych ward. Instead, we take to the streets like packs of jolly elves. The police beat us, but we don't care. We sing, we prevail, we make heroic speeches about peace and civil rights. We link arms, we dance, we integrate schools, we walk on water, we stop a war. We bring a president to his knees. The truth is, we did all that, but we did it bleeding. We did it afraid. For our song this week, well, we've been hearing today about what we all need to do to slow the global climate crisis. So let's hear Many Rivers to Cross. Here is Jimmy Cliff. That was Jimmy Cliff with Many Rivers to Cross. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you'd like to see who the guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, charlenespretnak.com, and click on the tab labeled Radio. Michael Braungart, who was going to be with us today, had to reschedule for later on. Till next week, this is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now.